From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Wayne Slater, co-author of the book Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. It's about President Bush's chief political advisor, who is described in the book as co-president. The book describes Rove's hardball techniques in getting his candidates elected. Attack, 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 he's advised. Attack your opponent's strengths. Voters already perceive the weaknesses. Slater is the Austin bureau chief of the Dallas Morning News and has covered George W. Bush since his successful gubernatorial campaign. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a new biography of Florence Nightingale by Gillian Gill. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush visited Florida today, touring areas that were hard hit by Hurricane Frances and signing a measure to give $2 billion in federal aid to the state. He told reporters at the National Hurricane Center in Miami that this is just the beginning.
As the damage is assessed, I will ask Congress for additional resources for infrastructure repair and disaster loan assistance to businesses and homeowners.
Most of the $2 billion the president signed off on today will go to replenish the disaster relief funds of the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Congressional Democrats are criticizing Vice President Dick Cheney for remarks at a political rally in Iowa yesterday. NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports.
Cheney warned voters that the U.S. could be hit by another terrorist attack if they elect John Kerry president this fall. House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi pounded Cheney for the comment.
It is completely inappropriate for the president, the vice president, to in effect threaten the American people, to be part of instilling fear into our country. And I would hope that the president of the United States would disassociate himself from any such comments.
Pelosi placed blame instead on President Bush, saying he was distracted by the Iraq war and therefore hasn't done enough to quash al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, The Capitol.
Republican leaders in Congress said today that they will allow a 10-year ban on some military-style assault weapons to expire next week without allowing a vote on it. Police chiefs from the District of Columbia, Los Angeles, Atlanta, and Seattle called on Congress today to renew the ban, saying that allowing it to expire will lead to more violent crimes using the guns. The law bans 19 types of military-style weapons. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has agreed to changes in the route of Israel's barrier in and around the West Bank, but Sharon insisted on keeping several Jewish settlement blocks on the Israeli side of the barrier. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
In June, the Israeli Supreme Court ruled the barrier's planned route should take up less Palestinian land. After that decision, the Defense Ministry began work on a new route. Sharon today approved the defense ministry plan in principle, but said it will be brought before the cabinet for approval. He said the new route is closer to the border between the West Bank and Israel, but still includes the large settlements of Maale Adumim and Ariel and the block of settlements of Gush Etzion near Bethlehem. However, a group of isolated settlements on the southern edge of the West Bank would now be excluded. Israeli officials traveled to the U.S. later this week to present the map to the Bush administration. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The Dow lost 29 to 10,313. The Nasdaq was down 8 to 1850. This is NPR News. A federal judge has sentenced investment banker Frank Quattrone to 18 months in prison. Quattrone was convicted last May of obstructing an investigation into the way his firm doled out shares of stock to favored customers. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
After the sentencing, Quattrone told reporters, "I can hold my head high because I know I'm innocent." He also said he would appeal his conviction. Quattrone was sentenced to three terms of 18 months each. The sentences will run concurrently. He also received a $90,000 fine. Quatron was the highly paid head of the technology group at Credit Suisse First Boston. He was accused of obstructing justice by sending an email to his staff urging them to clean up their files. At the time, a grand jury was investigating whether the firm illegally doled out shares of initial public offering stock to executives of companies it did business with. Quatron was ordered to report to the Lompoc prison camp in California within 50 days. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
Scientists are hoping to salvage some material from the Genesis space capsule, which crashed today in the Utah desert after its parachute failed to deploy. The capsule has been orbiting the sun for more than 3 years, collecting particles from the solar wind. Scientists hoped that by analyzing the particles, they could gain clues about the origin of the sun and its planets. Two Hollywood stunt pilots had been employed to fly a helicopter that would catch the capsule's parachute as it plunged to Earth. They were unable to do that because the capsule began tumbling and its parachute failed to open. The capsule hit the desert floor so hard it was driven halfway into the ground. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR Shop introduces Driveway Moments 2, the second collection of public radio stories so compelling they won't let you go, at NPR.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Wayne Slater, is the co-author of the book Bush's Brain. It's about Karl Rove, President Bush's chief political advisor. The book not only describes Rove as the political mastermind of the administration, it describes him as a new species of advisor, a political advisor who is so influential on policy, he is a co-president. Rove has been advising George W. Bush for over 10 years and has worked with his father. Wayne Slater is the Austin bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News. He covered the administrations of Texas governors Bill Clements, Ann Richards, and George W. Bush. Slater also covered Bush's 2000 presidential campaign and every Democratic and Republican convention since 1988. Let me read a couple of things that Karl Rove has said about his techniques when it comes to campaigning. And the first is from a memo that he wrote in 1986 when he was representing Bill Clements in his campaign for Texas governor against Mark White. And Karl Rove said in this strategy memo, "Anti-white messages are more important than positive Clement messages. Attack, attack, attack." And then in 1994, when describing his techniques, he said, "I don't attack people on their weakness. That usually doesn't get the job done. Voters already perceive weakness. You've got to go after the other guy's strengths. That's how you win." Are these techniques unusual, or is this something that Karl Rove originates, or are these kind of typical techniques for political strategists?
They're not typical techniques. Attack, attack, attack is obviously something that candidates like to do. But what Karl Rove has done in the current race and in this long series of events, as we've chronicled in the book, what he has done is sought out the strength of your opponent. If John Kerry's strength is that he was a war hero, you seek out that strength and destroy it or damage it. If John McCain's strength was that he was a prisoner of war and a hero by that, then you seek that out. In this case, there was an independent group that emerged, you may remember, in 2000, a veterans group that raised questions about whether John McCain had the temperament to be president or not. That was code. In effect, they were saying, did his years as a prisoner of war make him crazy? So you sought the strength of McCain, not the weakness. In the case of Ann Richards, in 1994, when George Bush ran against Ann Richards, her strength was her openness, her tolerance, the diversity of her administration. She brought women in, she brought minorities in, she brought gays and lesbians into positions of authority. And so a whisper campaign emerged in East Texas, a very conservative but Democrat part of the state, that began to raise questions about whether Ann Richards surrounded herself with homosexuals and lesbians. That damaged her efforts in a key part of the state. Ultimately, a key Bush person went public with those comments, and may have caused, at least if not the election, certainly damaged her enough where other elements in the campaign did not save her. In every case, and in others as well, you attack not the weakness of your opponent, but the strength. Although it's probably been done before, Karl Rove has made this a sort of way a new way in which political consultants operate, and I guarantee you that others, younger on both sides, are watching this model, and we'll see it again and again.
Now, you say one of the techniques of Karl Rove is to leave no fingerprints. If you're, what do you mean by that?
Well, the amazing thing about Carl, I can remember doing the Whisper campaign in 1994 with Ann Richards, and I tried to engage Carl from time to time. We would talk, if not daily, at least weekly, try to engage him in his role as part of this Whisper campaign, and he took great pains to distance himself from that, as he does in most other things. Throughout his career, it has been difficult for me and Jim Moore, my colleague on the book, to find absolute rock-solid on-paper evidence that Karl Rove was the key instrument which went after these dirty tricks or this hardball politics or whatever. But what we see is a pattern of activity which is always the same, where Karl's tough, sometimes dirty tricks, sometimes what we call smash-mouth politics. But in each case, you'll see another group emerge, another organization, a Whisper campaign independent of the candidate. And in each case, in almost every case, Karl has been successful in saying, I had nothing to do with anything that's going on here, even though over the course of a decade and a half, each episode bears a striking resemblance to the episode before it.
So you have no evidence that Karl Rove has anything to do with the Swift Boat campaign, against John Kerry, right?
That's absolutely right. What I know is there's this pattern of activity, and this fits perfectly into that pattern. I absolutely do not have evidence that Karl Rove was personally responsible for the Swift Boat campaign. But you begin to look at two things. One is the links between the Swift Boat veteran organization, not the vets themselves, but sort of the Republican apparatus that assembled itself around the Swift Boat veterans and really helped organize and push the effort forward. Those are all people who Karl Rove has dealt with in the past. In one case, the big early funder, a guy named Bob Perry, a home builder from Houston, Texas, worked with Karl Rove in the Clements race, a Republican governor's race in the mid-80s. So you have these links, these Republicans who have links with Karl over the years involved in the Swift Boat veterans. But I think even more persuasive than that is that it is the Swift Boat veteran attack on Kerry is an absolute pristine model of the exact kind of attack. Go after the strength, leave no fingerprints. Very often, the attack is done by an independent group with some ties but no absolute proof to Rove that we have seen for a decade and a half.
Now, you know, as a journalist, where is that line between saying that there are clues here that Karl Rove might be involved? The line between that and just either, you know, smearing Karl Rove or, you know, accusing him through innuendo, the equivalent of what you're accusing him of doing?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I'm not sure that I have a satisfactory answer, but let me say two things. One is sort of, I look at this as a scientific method. That is to say, if you do an experiment 10 times, and in every case the pattern is exactly the same, then one must have, then it's either a coincidence, an extraordinary coincidence, that these episodes that have a remarkable similarity keep happening with the same figure or a couple of figures in charge, or it is really that somewhat evidence, even if it's indirect evidence. But more important than that, the thing about Karl, and I know him very well, is that he is in charge of everything. Ask anyone who knows him. Watch him run a campaign from the 80s to the presidential race in 2004. He knows how many districts, how they voted in Orange County, Iowa, in 2000, and frankly, probably knows how they voted in 1972 in the Nixon race. He also knows every detail of every campaign. He works 18, 20 hours a day. He's a marvel. He's an absolute extraordinary person who I have watched over the course of years, who knows everything about every campaign. And so for him to then say, I didn't know about this one moment, but I know about everything else, in every campaign, I think, is simply not credible.
Now, one of the tactics that you've said he uses is the whisper campaign. What is a whisper campaign?
It's really, you know, there's a, the key to a whisper campaign is it has to resonate against something else. In the case of McCain, for example, in 2000, we began hearing in places like South Carolina, where Bush was in trouble after the loss in the primary, Republican primary in New Hampshire, we began hearing two things. One, a whisper campaign that raised questions about McCain's stability, his intellectual stability. Secondly, we began to hear, I guess, a whisper campaign about whether or not McCain and his wife had a black child, a minority child. In fact, he and Cindy McCain do have a child. It is a child they adopted from a Mother Teresa-related orphanage. But in the sort of heat of battle in South Carolina, you began hearing telephone calls made. Sort of these anonymous groups would make calls and leave messages raising questions about
McCain. On your machine? They'd leave messages on your answering
machine? They would. Absolutely. And South Carolina voters got that in 2000 in the primary. They would hear what basically is called a push poll or a push campaign, where someone would leave messages or talk to the person at the end of the phone. These are Republican voters. Some anonymous group or some group that would give some innocuous name that doesn't really exist and say, did you know that Senator McCain and his wife have a black child? Now, this is a southern state, a Republican primary, and stakes are very high. And there was some truth to it. They did indeed have a minority child. The calls were made and left on some campaigns. Emails were sent. Some people, I saw some of those in 2000, raising questions of whether or not John McCain's wife had problems with drugs. In fact, Cindy McCain talked publicly after this about having a problem with prescription medication. So there was an element of truth to this whisper campaign. But the savage part of it is it distorts reality. It simply isn't true, even though there's a modicum of truth.
Now, in 1999, you got into a big argument with Karl Rove after you wrote a story for your paper, the Dallas Morning News, saying that Rove was behind the smear campaign against John McCain. And he said Rove said that you were trying to ruin him. And I think
right.
You nearly came to blows.
In fact, he was allowed to hit me on my, poke me on my lapel. When I poked him, he said, don't touch me. So I'm not sure we would ever have gone to blows, but it was a very, very vigorous conversation on the tarmac of an airport. But be clear about, I think, what this conversation was about. He was unhappy that I had raised an issue. I had an historic perspective that many in brand new members of the National Press Corps, newly assembled to cover this Bush campaign early in the campaign, did not have. And so I was able to kind of begin to connect some of the dots and raise questions about these kind of activity. So he wasn't really very happy about that. But Terry, that wasn't what that conversation was about. When he, I say yelled at me, when we had our vigorous conversation on the tarmac, after it was over, he turned around and stormed away. And I looked over, and just a few, a dozen yards away, there was the entire National Press Corps behind barriers, waiting for the arrival of George Bush. And what they had seen was Karl Rove dressing down a reporter vigorously. And the message that Karl was trying to send was, don't mess with me. Don't mess with me if you're a reporter, because if you do something that I don't like, you will pay for it. You will hear for it from me.
Do you feel like you paid consequences for writing the story that you wrote about Karl Rove? Did you lose any access?
I did not because, I'm being honest. The truth is, Karl talked to me later because I think we knew what this was about. I had very, very good connections with others in the administration. These are people I had known, Karen Hughes, Scott McClelland, and others I had known for many, many years. Moreover, I know the president, and I knew George Bush very, very well, and we, during the early part of that campaign, would talk a lot, pretty much daily.
My guest is Wayne Slater, co-author of Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. It's the basis of a new documentary film. Slater is Austin bureau chief of the Dallas Morning News. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Wayne Slater. He's the co-author of the book Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. And Wayne Slater is Austin bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News. Now, you think that although you can't present hardcore evidence that Karl Rove is behind the Swift Boat anti-Kerry campaign, you think that that campaign has all the trademarks of Karl Rove, Karl Rove tactics. What is your analysis of how the press has covered the Swift Boat campaign against Kerry?
You know, I've thought about that. I think many of us in journalism have tried to think, how might we have done this better? Because ultimately, if you look at the initial charges by the Swift Boat veterans in the first ad, those charges essentially, with respect to the medals, have been disproved by the public record. But it didn't end the story. In fact, the stories continue to develop. An alternative would have been somehow for all of us to have taken a breath and waited until we could evaluate the specific charges with respect to the medals and then write what ultimately did happen with a series of stories in the New York Times and Washington Post and elsewhere, and that's that the charges themselves about the medals lack merit. But we didn't have time to do that. Talk radio was full of the story. The cable television channels were talking, especially Fox News, was talking about it a lot. It reminds me of an old phrase that Karl Rove and his mentor, Lee Atwater, the famous Republican operative, had years and years ago in the 70s. If you're explaining, you're losing. And what they mean by that is if you can get your opponent on the run where you make a charge and you leave your opponent involved in explaining why the charge is wrong, that's fine. You've won. The person who makes the charge wins if the other looks defensive in trying to explain why the charge is in error.
You make an interesting contrast between Karl Rove and President Bush. You say that President Bush didn't become interested in politics until shortly before he was elected governor, but that Karl Rove was, it almost seems like he was born interested in politics. He was always interested in politics. And in fact, even when he was in college, he became the executive director of the College Republican National Committee. Now, during his tenure at the College Republican Committee, he was responsible for, a dirty trick, something I think would be classically described as a dirty trick, against who?
Well, he did a number of things. In one case, while he was a young college Republican, he thought it would be a good idea to, in effect, break into or go into the headquarters of a guy running for public office in Illinois, a Democrat, to steal some copies of the stationery for the campaign, to type up a fake sort of invitation to an opening, to the opening of the headquarters, political headquarters of this Democratic opponent. And he distributed, made about 1,000 copies or so, and distributed those to homeless shelters, hippie communes, again, this is some time ago, and other places in order to basically encourage a whole bunch of people to show up for this event. He wrote in this invitation, I guess it was an early indication of Karl's style, free drink, free food, free beer, and free women, I think. I don't know, or girls, I believe. Some reference to that effect. It certainly encouraged a number of people to go and spoil the opening of this candidate's headquarters. It was funny stuff. And what happened in the case of Rove was that in those years, as a young college Republican, he and his pal, fellow collegian Lee Atwater, ran for the head of the president of the College Republicans. That was an important job in those days because it was an organization that actually had an office in the Republican National Committee. And during the course of this effort, when he was elected, he and Atwater would hold these seminars for young collegiate Republicans. And during these seminars, he would talk about dirty tricks, including that one. Here's what you can do. You can steal the stationery. You can go through the garbage of your opponents and various other dirty trick techniques.
So you know he did this because he talked about it at seminars that he gave.
Absolutely. There's tapes. There are tapes of him doing this. It then got public notice in the Washington Post. There was a brief story in the Washington Post at the time. You have to remember this moment. This was in 1972, at the height near the height of Watergate. And so this whole business in 72 and 73 about a person associated with the Republican National Committee who was talking about dirty tricks had a sensitivity then that probably we don't have today. So the head of the Republican Party, chairman of the National Republican Party, agreed to investigate to see what this young guy, Karl Rove, was doing and his fellow Lee Atwater. He investigated this for a month or two and at the end decided, the chairman of the Republican Party, everything was fine. He looked into it. There hadn't been any breaches of any kind of problem. He then hired Karl Rove at the Republican National Committee. That man was George Herbert Walker Bush, who was then the chairman of the Republican Party. And that was how Karl Rove and the Bush family got together.
Are you suggesting there at all that George H.W. Bush went easy on Karl Rove?
Well, he did. he absolutely did. I think he probably had the same admiration for Karl that I do, and that's that he's an extraordinarily competitive person. I think at the time this looked like fairly minor dirty tricks that weren't very important. I think the father saw in Rove an extraordinary intellect, a strategic thinker, and even in those stages that I think has turned out to be true. So yeah, the father did that. In those days, incidentally, Karl's job as a young person at the Republican National Committee, this being in the early 70s, was to hand the car keys to the chairman's son, George W. Bush, who would come in from Harvard and want to get the family car, a Gremlin, and cruise Georgetown for a weekend.
Wayne Slater is co-author of Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. It's the basis of the new documentary film Bush's Brain. Slater is Austin Bureau Chief of the Dallas Morning News. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the Sundance Channel, presenting with Air America Radio, The Al Franken Show, delivering comedy segments and political commentary, premieres weeknights at 11:30 on Sundance Channel. And from the German Information Center, the shortcut to Germany on the web at www.germany.info. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how Karl Rove convinced George W. Bush to enter politics. We continue our conversation with Wayne Slater, co-author of Bush's Brain. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a new biography of Florence Nightingale. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Wayne Slater, co-author of the book Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. It's about the president's chief political advisor, Karl Rove. Slater is the Austin bureau chief of the Dallas Morning News and started covering George W. Bush during his successful gubernatorial campaign. You give Karl Rove a lot of credit for being the one who convinced George W. Bush to actually enter politics. You don't say that he did it alone, but that he had a lot of sway in that decision. What did Karl Rove do, to your knowledge, to help convince George W. Bush to enter politics?
You know, I remember back in 1988 when the father won the nomination to run the presidency in that case. And Karl was in the hall encouraging some Texas reporters about the prospects, future prospects, of George Herbert Walker Bush's son, George W., who most of us never heard of. We didn't even know who the son was. But Karl was already working out sort of this blueprint, this political calculus that he hoped, obviously, one of these days would lead the son to higher public office. In February of 1990, in Austin, Texas, Karl sat down with a fellow political operative, and they talked about a number of campaigns that they were both running. One of those campaigns was not George W. Bush, but that's who Karl Rove wanted to talk about. And he talked about George W. This is the guy I really wish was running. He was really great. He's extraordinary. This is how I could make him governor of Texas. And he explained how he could do it. And this is how I could make him president of the United States. And here's why. And he explained, this is February of 1990. At that time, George W. Bush was with the Texas Rangers baseball team. He had never held any public office. And already, Rove had in his mind a fairly specific blueprint about how he thought this man could become president, and more importantly, how he, Karl Rove, would lead to this process, beginning with a race for governor, which ultimately happened in 1994.
Now, you say that before George W. Bush ran for governor of Texas, he really didn't know much about state politics, but Karl Rove began an extensive series of tutorials. What were those tutorials?
It was very, very smart. What basically Rove did was, again, understanding that George Bush, even though he had grown up in a political family and was astute politically, did not know a lot about the nuts and bolts of state government. How big is the budget? How do you pay for highway transportation in some detail? How are social services really funded and by whom and what percentages and so forth? And so what he did, what Karl did, was assemble some people who he knew and trusted. Very small coterie of experts, most of them lobbyists in Austin. And he began a school that lasted for months. What would happen is these people would come in and explain to Bush, here's what a budget is, and here's how big the budget is, and here's what all funds are, and here's the state funds, and so forth and so on. Here's how transportation, here's how education is funded, here's how our testing system works. And they had months and months of basic schooling in which George Bush was schooled on what Texas government was. I watched this process close up because even though the schooling was secret at the time, and I didn't realize at that moment it was going on, early on, I had talked to Bush when he was very early a candidate for governor and began to ask him in San Antonio one day some questions about public education, and he simply could not answer them. He simply didn't know. It was shortly after that that Rove, in effect, began this schooling process and dispatched Bush to what I call the B markets, very small towns where he would meet with Rotarians and others who were sympathetic audiences, where he could build some confidence in his ability as a candidate. When I saw him in the summer of 1990, after the primary was over, he George Bush, was a different man. He truly understood state government in great detail. The schooling, which I later learned had happened, had been very, very successful. We saw exactly the same thing as Bush approached the presidency, where Karl Rove was involved with others in bringing in Condoleezza Rice, Paul Wolfowitz, and others to Austin, Texas, to meet at the mansion and to tutor the governor, George Bush, in 1998 and early 1999, on the details of both domestic policy and foreign policy.
Now, you've described a little bit the whisper campaign that you suspect Karl Rove was behind during George W. Bush's campaign for governor against the incumbent Ann Richards. As part of Karl Rove's strategy, apparently, the campaign prepared an ad for George W. Bush, with Bush saying that that Ann Richards had attacked him personally.
Yes.
Before any such attack was made, but the ad was ready to go in case such an attack ever happened. Would you discuss the ad and the strategy behind it and how it was used?
Oh, it was nicely done. what you see again and again, and this is just good politics, you've seen in this relationship between Karl Rove, this political genius, and George Bush, this extraordinarily good candidate. He really was a wonderful candidate in Texas and was a pretty good candidate in 2000, and I think has emerged in many ways as a sort of open, gregarious candidate who's won over at least some folks. What you see are two different parts of the same whole. But key to that is that George Bush always pursues the high road. My candidate, my opponent is great, and I'm approaching these things and the issues are important. Rove has always sort of involved himself with the political, strategic details, often what one would call the low road. And those would be the attacks and the political detail. Bush himself has tried to stay away from it. Now, one of the things that was important in 1994, and I know this because obviously I was there and talked to campaigns on both sides, various people, was that there was an extra sensitivity about George Bush running against Ann Richards, in part because she was a beloved figure in Texas among many people. Moreover, she was a woman. And whether we like it or not, the Bush people fairly calculated that for Bush to attack her too vigorously in a way that appeared to be personal would be a mistake. We saw that in 1990 when Ann Richards won for governor against a guy who really kind of attacked her, and we Texans didn't like that. And so what Bush did was maintain the high road throughout the campaign. Oh, I respect my opponent. She's done a good job for Texas. But there are some policy issues that divide us. Meanwhile, you saw the whisper campaign going on and other efforts by the Bush staff and others to bother Richards, to encourage her to maybe pop off and to attack Bush in some way. Anticipating that that might happen, they put together a commercial before Ann Richards had ever said anything about him, in which George Bush looks directly at the television, at the camera, and very solemnly says, "I am sorry, but that my opponent has chosen to attack me personally." Very effective commercial. At that point, they made the commercial, had it done, and actually distributed to various television studios and being held there. No one had attacked him. Richards had not said anything. But at the appropriate moment, when Richards popped off, when Ann Richards popped off, I think this was the point where she said some jerk or something comes around and says something about you. At that moment, the Bush campaign pulled the trigger, and this commercial, very effective commercial, appeared all over the state just instantly. And in that one moment, it sort of helped create an environment in which Bush was telling people, and people, the polls showed, they believed it, Ann Richards is attacking George Bush personally, and it was very, 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 very effective.
My guest is Wayne Slater, co-author of Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. It's the basis of a new documentary film of the same name. Slater is Austin Bureau Chief of the Dallas Morning News. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Wayne Slater, co-author of Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. Now, something else you say about Karl Rove and his relationship to George W. Bush. You say it was Rove who was the architect of George W. Bush's turn to the right. What did he do to influence that?
You know, I was just talking with a friend in New York at the Republican National Convention, and it's so extraordinary for many of us here in Texas to see the situation as it is now. George Bush had no enemies in Texas. Obviously, he had some, but by and large, the political environment that he operated in as governor was one of bipartisanship, one of working with people. In part, that was by necessity. In part, it was frankly just good politics and the way the state operates. But he created an environment, and he operated in that environment in which he was really able to talk about conservative ideas, but did so in a way that compassionate conservatism sort of manifested itself. He was conservative. He didn't talk much about abortion. He did talk a lot about education in Texas as governor. But these were the elements that would help him win in Texas. Once he became a candidate for president, and certainly as president, what you saw was Karl Rove putting together the numbers. That's what he's good at. He's good at what constituency will produce these numbers. In the case of the turn to the right, what Rove saw politically was the extraordinary value of what Bush had from the beginning as a Republican, and certainly has now as a Republican president. And that's a socially conservative base, by and large Christian conservatives, who are the key, who are important for his reelection, but they're absolutely the key to his reelection. In the event that George Bush talks about abortion, it is a message to this group. It's a group his father never had. And one of the lessons that both the president and his political advisor, Karl Rove, have learned is that you have to have this group, socially conservative Americans, by and large Christian conservatives in the South, but also in places like Southeast Ohio, or in portions of Missouri and Wisconsin, who are going to be a key part of your political base. And if George Bush wins re-election, I think what we'll see in those numbers is that Rove was right, that the effort, whatever effort the Kerry people have to win over persuadable or undecided voters on economic issues over the next 2 months, will be more than dwarfed in Karl Rove's arithmetic by the increased turnout by Bush's base, social conservatives, those who have found his positions on the right appealing. It is a purely political calculation. It is a policy movement over time designed to maximize the number of votes he gets on November 2004. And Rove was thinking about this in 1999.
The fact that George W. Bush was born again is a very important part of his personal story. Do you think that the emphasis that he's placed on that has anything to do with Karl Rove?
I have to say that that's yes and no. I know the president. I've talked to him as governor privately a lot about religion early on. He came, I think, to talk publicly about religion. A lot of people, I think, would think that he's always talked publicly about his religious faith and so forth in an easy way. It was actually a sort of a development that happened in 1999. He felt more comfortable as he began to run for president, talking in really open ways about his faith and so forth. I believe it's real. I believe this is something that's heartfelt for the president. I believe when he uses the word wonder-working power, when he talks to Christian groups and pastors about faith, when he asks people to pray for him in the White House, in the Oval Office, as some pastors I've talked to say he has, this is heartfelt and real and authentic. At the same time, I think Karl Rove, who early on hired Ralph Reed in the initial presidential race, Ralph Reed, after he had been Christian Coalition chairman, and brought him on board on the Bush side, understands the political benefits of this kind of expression. So I don't want to be misunderstood. I don't believe that the president talks about religion in a very open way because he simply wants to be reelected and it's for political purposes. At the same time, I believe that Rove understands that there are gold, there's gold in them there religious phrases in places where the president needs those votes.
It's clear that Karl Rove is a brilliant strategist. Does he have political beliefs beyond strategy? Does he have strong beliefs about abortion or gay marriage or the war in Iraq?
My experience with Karl over the years is that he is conservative. He tends to support the kind of fiscal conservative policies that Republicans do. He's mildly interested in the issues of abortion. He is amoral in the sense that he's not religious in any fundamental way. Karl's element is to win. That is his religion. That is his politics. He doesn't like he doesn't oppose abortion because abortion's bad. He likes to support efforts to oppose abortion because it's a winning strategy. He is all about winning and putting together the elements, whatever the policies are, that will reach that end. He's not an ideologue, really. What he is a winner.
Karl Rove has said that this presidential campaign will be his last national campaign because the only president or only presidential candidate he feels he could work for is George W. Bush. So what do you think happens with Karl Rove after this campaign?
I think Karl probably will put a shingle up in Washington and maybe come back to Austin to teach. But more important than that is a vision that Karl Rove has. He doesn't just want to reelect the man he first helped elect president. He wants to do something more fundamental, a realignment of our government, the politics of America. He saw in the pattern of William McKinley, who won at the end of the last century, and began what began, I think, a 30-year period of Republican dominance, largely Republican dominance of politics, with the exception of the Wilson years. He saw in that a pattern. It ended only with the Depression and Franklin Roosevelt and another realignment of our government. Rove would like to see, with this president and with this Congress, the beginnings of a process where American political life is realigned fundamentally with the Republican Party so that it's not just a president or two, it's not just a few Congresses, but 20, 30, 40 years of Republican dominance, business dominance in American political life. And if that, although it's unlikely to happen, does happen at the beginning, you'll see Karl Rove as the mentor for future Karl Roves and future advisors of what he sees and hopes to be decades of Republican dominance of American politics.
Does Karl Rove have business connections, financial business connections that he stands to profit from with Republican victories outside of the fees that he makes?
Karl Rove basically has given up the kind of money that he could have made had he not just stayed with the President of the United States, at least in the short term. In the past years, he has had business connections with direct mail business, which he started, and others where he made money as a consultant. But over the last 6 years, he has represented this president alone and has made relatively little money, based on what I've seen. But, of course, the moment he's out of office, the moment the president is finished, Karl Rove is worth millions.
Have you heard anything from Karl Rove about your book, Bush's Brain?
The funny thing about Karl is he understands that on the one hand, the book is critical, but it has sort of fed the myth. What's wrong, after all, with the idea of a book that says that you're extraordinarily powerful, close to the President of the United States, and that you're at the right hand of power and you will do anything to defeat your enemies? In Washington, that's the kind of credential you want. One day, Karl called me from the White House and said, "I know where you live. I know where you live," and he does. "I know the highway you're on," and I happen to actually have been on it at that moment. "We can send Patriot missiles and hit you there. Boom, boom, boom." And we laughed. And yet, there was something kind of odd about that. A guy was calling from the White House and did know where I lived. And it is a place that controls the Patriot missiles. But I think he was kidding.
Since Karl Rove plays such hardball and he's out to win, and of course, who isn't out to win in politics, but some people go further than others in that effort to win, do you know enough about him personally to know what's behind that drive?
You know, the interesting thing about Carl is he not only is intellectually brilliant, and we saw that as I talked to some of his friends in high school. Even then, he was driven. He was brilliant. He was smarter than everybody else. He had more energy than anybody else. Two things, I think, and this is probably pop psychology, but his father was not around. They had a difficult problem when his father finally left. And ultimately, his mother, who he was close with, killed herself. He found, I think, in the Republican Party early in Salt Lake City, a kind of father figure in the sense that there was stability and force and strength and a masculine policy that I think fit this young man as he had all this energy and this intellect at a key time. And the way he's directed it is to become the strongest, toughest, meanest, most extraordinarily brilliant, I think, political operative that we've seen in a number of years.
Wayne Slater, thank you so much for talking with us.
Great to be with you, Terry.
Wayne Slater is the author of the book Bush's Brain. Coming up, a new biography of Florence Nightingale. This is Fresh Air. Biographer Gillian Gill, who's chronicled the life of Agatha Christie, has turned her attention to another woman of mystery, Florence Nightingale. Gill's book, Nightingales, is a biography of the Nightingale family, as well as an intensive crash course in Victorian culture, particularly the culture of upper-middle-class reformers out of which Florence sprang. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
The Lady with the Lamp. That's the solitary, ethereal image that's come down to us of Florence Nightingale. Walking the hospital wards in the dead of night, she was a beacon of benevolence to her patients, the thousands of ordinary British soldiers who were felled by cholera and pestilence during the Crimean War. But even saints have families. If Gillian Gill's erudite, funny, and deliciously overwhelming biography, called Nightingales, can be said to have one overarching thesis, it's summed up in that assertion. That even saints like Florence Nightingale, whose life was so profoundly other it seems to transcend the mundane shaping forces of family and society, in fact had a family with whom she was lovingly, painfully enmeshed. There was her plain Jane, invalid older sister named Parthenope, whose adoration Florence alternately sought and shunned. Her mother, Fanny, who fruitlessly schemed for her two daughters to make brilliant matches. And her broad-minded father, William Edward, who encouraged his second daughter's forays into classical literature and mathematics, and then became flummoxed as he saw how far afield her intellectual curiosities led her. Florence Nightingale, as Gill and other biographers have documented, was a mystic. She claimed she first heard the voice of God at 17, calling her to his service. Thereafter, she yearned to be on her own, but up until age 34, when she escaped to the Crimea and into legend, Florence was well-nigh choked by the daily attentions of her family. Here's how Gill describes that relationship. It wasn't that Florence's family was cruel or neglectful. It was their utter predictability and lack of vision she could not bear. They were all three so boring, so satisfied with their lives. Her father read interminably from the newspapers, force-feeding her like a goose. Her mother and sister dashed about to parties. If her family had disowned her, like so many daughters in popular fiction, her road to heaven would have been easier. But instead, the other three Nightingales persisted in loving Florence. The burden of their love and need was insupportable, as was their inability to understand why she could not be happy with them. That passage gives you a taste of Gill's style, vivacious without being distracting. Throughout Nightingales, Gill interjects her own first-person voice to weigh in on crucial debates about Florence's life, like, was she a lesbian or wasn't she? Gill says Florence was more celibate saint than sapphist, and good thing too, since one of the men who unsuccessfully proposed marriage to her was Richard Monckton Milnes, whose double life, Gill dryly comments, would have made Oscar Wilde green with envy. In addition to her thoughtful first-person interjections, a subtler but ultimately more striking feature of Gill's biography is how it veers away from devoting most of its attention to Florence's public accomplishments in the Crimea. Instead, Gill is fascinated by the long, odd gestation of this ambitious woman. When the biography does at last arrive at those transformative 21 months that Florence spent in the Crimea supervising nursing operations for the British government, we readers have a vivid understanding of just how this proper Victorian virgin wound up in the nightmarishly huge and filthy barrack hospital at Scutari, tending in the most intimate of ways to men's bodies. Incurring the wrath of army medical officers for her hygienic and dietary reforms, Florence had to be meek in person. But in private letters, like this one to ex-cabinet minister Sidney Herbert, she was an angry, avenging angel. A great deal has been said of my self-sacrifice, heroism, and so forth. The real humiliation, the real hardship of this place, is that we have to do with men who are neither gentlemen, nor men of education, nor even men of business, nor men of feeling, whose only object is to keep themselves out of blame. Florence spent most of the 52 years after the Crimean War as a furiously busy invalid recluse. She refused visits from her family, ate her meals alone in her bedroom, and, as Gill says, successfully fled her body and turned herself into paper. Gill is referring to the mountains of pages Florence generated on the topic of army medical reform, as well as on her religious beliefs and family. The Lady with the Lamp. After you read Nightingales, you may well feel as I do, that accolade belongs not just to Florence, but to her latest biographer, who shines light into the shadows of the life story of this most singular of eminent Victorians.
Maureen Corrigan reviewed Nightingales by Gillian Gill. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, Michael Clare, author of Blood and Oil, The Dangers and Consequences of America's Growing Petroleum Dependency. He says our addiction to oil is driving our foreign policy and converting our military into an oil protection service. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.